Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me, and I want to call him my beloved co-host today,
okay,
because we'll be talking with Professor Heidi Weymouth about compassion. She's a former chairman of the Department of Psychological Sciences up at NAU, and she's organized a conference. This is the fourth year of the Compassion in Everyday Life conference.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what Mike thinks, my beloved co-host, but
you'll know in a minute.
Yeah. but if there's anything that our society is not structured to do, is it's not based on compassion.
It doesn't seem that way, does it? It seems like we laugh at it. It seems like, you know, the Dalai Lama. And of course, for most of American society, Dalai Lama is like a cartoon character, and not to be taken seriously.
Let's talk a little bit about, I think everybody assumes they know what compassion is, but talk a little bit about, Heidi, about the definition of what compassion is, say compared to sympathy or empathy or generosity, other virtues.
Okay, well, and first of all, I just want to say thanks for inviting me here today. And
it's, you say that now.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll say it later, too. But I'm a social psychologist by training, and one of the things that, common understanding of compassion, the word means to feel with, to be able to see someone suffering. So there, and at every phase of this definition, I have to say there are all kinds of sort of qualifications potentially. But the simplest definition is to notice the suffering of others, and that noticing brings some discomfort and desire to alleviate the suffering of someone, and then to intend to help take away the suffering, and then ultimately to do something about the
compassion
suffering.
Compassion includes action.
Right. So it really has the traditional definition is really focused on action. And one of the things I think is interesting, I take a broader perspective on that, because sometimes I think in our society we think that compassion is what someone who has elevated resources can do for someone who is in need. And that's a great idea. I mean, we would hate to see that go away, but I think compassion in everyday life, and this is one of the reasons for this conference, is the idea that it isn't just that. It's the way we see the world. It's the way we think. And sometimes I think some of the most compassionate actions are the things we don't say or don't do. And that's not that easily measured. And it could be something, and this is an example that I think is, happens a lot, but in a social situation, we're sort of likely to jump to conclusions, make assumptions about people, come up with simple kinds of answers, which I'm sure, we can talk about when we talk about sort of the current political climate about the good guys and the bad guys and this, that, and the other. We make these very simplistic explanations. A compassionate response is to also say to oneself, well, maybe I don't know everything. And maybe I really shouldn't rush to judgment right here. And I think that's compassion.
Well, that's
too.
It. And part of our topic this morning is, which I giggled at all the way through the parking lot, was compassion in politics. And in 2016, it seems like this particular endeavor and this particular election is the furthest thing from compassion, especially as you just defined it, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, determining what's behind actions is not. In fact, and one of the things I do also want to get to in the next 45 minutes is how compassion is seen as weakness, certainly by conservatives. The name of the show is Democratic Perspective. We believe we can call it reasonable perspective because we're not advocating any perspective other than reasonableness, because the other side is freaking nuts. And so
why? Yeah, I guess the question is, why in our society
is, as Mike says, compassion almost has a negative sense. Why is it that it is not important? Why haven't we structured a world and a society that's based on compassion? And whether it's, you know, and I know exactly what you're talking about. In meeting people, I quickly used to, particularly when I was younger, would judge them immediately. And then I would find out so often that I was wrong.
Right.
And after you do that for 40 years, you begin to get the idea that you shouldn't be so quick to judge people.
Yeah.
But it took a long time to figure that out. So compassion is almost like a water or a fluid that flows through society. It's pinched here. It's an ocean here. But
very metaphoric.
Yeah.
Cut it out.
And it's very, very metaphoric. But there are thousands of compassionate actions. For example, Doctors Without Borders, mm-hmm. working internationally, people working to alleviate the poor. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands of actions. But our society, I think, doesn't focus on compassion really as a value. We focus on, and Mike is right, that we're looking at a presidential race, which is a battle of giant egos, who can be the most egotistical, the most triumphant character, who can be the super guy, the superman. Compassion and getting a society that's based on compassion doesn't really come into this.
But that's interesting, you know, because if you look at every major religion or philosophical viewpoint, you know, compassion is a big part of that.
Of course, they all practice that.
Not always, right? The competing, I think there's competing essential values. So if you look at, on the one hand, and there's a lot of psychological research to back this up and in other areas as well, but the need for self-protection and self-defense is huge. And, you know, we like to study the fight or flight response. You know, there's a real need for self-protection. It's an important thing. And so a lot of what maybe looks like a lack of compassion is in defense of that need. So there's that.
Sure, that
But on the other side, you know, a lot of people, and people even say Darwin talked more about not survival of the fittest, but this empathy and altruism and compassion and taking care of one's own is also a super strong motive and has a physiological basis. And in fact, there's all kinds of benefits associated with moving beyond the self. And
the biological basis of that is what Darwin.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so there are these, and this has enjoyed a resurgence in the area of psychology in the last decade, I'd say. But these are really competing motives. And I think one of the things that my goals with this compassion conference and project is to sort of say, let's recognize that we have these two competing motives. And I think the compassionate side, you know, to answer your question, why aren't we more organized around that? I think there is a perception that somehow it's weak in our culture. You know, it's the aggressive and self-promoting. Those values seem to be higher, in our culture. But I think the compassionate thinking, you know, the expanded way of seeing oneself, it requires a motivation to sort of override the defensiveness that we
Let me go to a question that Mark had one time. This is a couple of years ago, and I thought it was really strong. And a bunch of young people were refugees, Mike, coming up from Nicaragua, El Salvador, places with the highest crime rates in the world. And Mike's question was, on air, was, why is our response to this relatively small, there's 320 million Americans. Why is our response to this fear and not compassion for them? That's what Mike mm-hmm. said. And he said it very, very strongly and very, very much from his heart. And it stuck with me, you know, 2 years later.
Yeah, when did we become a nation of pricks? You know, when did we become not nice people, all of us collectively? And I don't think that's true. And I want to. One of the things also I want to get to is you have a section of your conference called "The Value of Compassion Over Mere Sentiment," and it seems like an odd title for a section, you know. But it also shows a recognition that feeling sorry for somebody because they have circumstances that are not as good as yours, or they're trying to get into a country to escape virtual death.
So why is the response, and you talked about self-protection or fear, I would say, I call it fear. Why is that the overwhelming response to what, in a lot of ways, is a fairly minor social problem? I mean, you can look at the countries next to Syria, and they've got hundreds of thousands of refugees, and you've got Europe. The Germans are taking, 800,000 or a million refugees?
Europe is struggling with a compassionate response to this. I want to mention, we're talking to Heidi Wayman this morning. From a social science professor, from a social psychology professor from NAU, and who has a conference kind of coming up on compassion. And part of what we're going to get to is maybe everything we're talking about is political compassion in some way or another, as everything so much in life is politically connected or politically motivated. Now she can answer a question. Now let me know who she is.
I think it's a very complicated question. Obviously, I have my mother's German. I was recently in Germany and, very interested in the news and looking at and talking to people about sort of their feelings about the refugee crisis. And overwhelmingly, talking to people, the response is compassionate. I mean, I think, though, that on some level, the uncertainty. So, things sort of broke down for them. They had this initial invitation, wonderful feelings in October, and then suddenly it became apparent that the government had some issues with understanding what it was doing. They didn't have adequate stations set up to record, who was coming in and so forth. And so I think the fear also came from the idea that no one's in charge.
Right.
That suddenly it became this open-ended thing, and I think people like sort of being able to see where things are headed, right?
Sure.
And so the uncertainty, I think, is what aroused the fear.
Right, right.
And I think, fear and self-defense, so part of the research I do is really it's not to eliminate that. I think as human beings, it's impossible to eliminate this basic need for self-protection, self-esteem, self-enhancement. These are really important goals. And so, but if we balance that with a sort of motivated stance to bring some of those thoughts into the light and just sort of say, do I really have to feel this way right now? Or maybe I have a reaction that's a little defensive. I think part of what I like to call quiet ego is the ability to come back and sort of say, maybe I was wrong about that. Just to not, what we tend to do is once we make a statement or we have a thought, we just keep collecting evidence in favor of those statements, right? Bring that back and say, maybe not.
I see the U.S. as, and I've used the term before, a warrior race. And Americans argue that, and I used to argue it in the classroom. I liked being in college classrooms and starting with, is America a warrior race? And then give the evidence. I mean, I'm not making this up. I'm not saying that in our heart of hearts that we are bloodthirsty killers. But given the evidence, certainly our government seems to have an awful appreciation of war. So that in a warrior race, is compassion a weakness or a strength? Usually we would see compassion as a strength. It makes you a whole human being, makes you a participating member of the human race. Doing things for others is what... as you pointed out, all of the religions instruct us. Islam means peace. Christianity talks about this stuff all the time. But as a warrior race, it's a huge weakness, and I think it just falls out of the conversation completely. So to have a conference like this, would the three of you sit up there and share a cracker or something?
I think what's important is that that you're bringing the concept and experience of compassion to the forefront and really talking about it at a conference. It seems a very original idea to me, a very different kind of thing.
Yes, very original. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it isn't. But, right. Well, but in 2016, it seems, wow, this is from left field.
They're going to have a conference on compassion? I mean,
well, you know,
wow.
We had some really, the way this came about was very kind of neat, actually. We had some local communities, I hope they don't mind me mentioning their names, James Friedland and Jean Malecki. Married couple physicians who came to Northern Arizona, and they actually made a very nice donation to the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences because they wanted to see something like this move forward, you know, to have a nice tie with the community. And so my research kind of coalesced with that idea, and our goal is really to sort of not just say you should be compassionate, but try to understand, again, this is the fourth year, we've had, I think, over 40 disciplines represented. When we first had meetings at NAU, we had faculty from the entire university there because they're interested in some form of this definition. And again, it's a broad definition,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And
what applies to so many, as you just pointed out, so many fields, so many endeavors.
Right. And like
different.
This one, you mentioned the value of compassion over mere sentiment. These two of our very well-known philosophers are going to be talking about that. And I honestly don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
I co-taught a course with Julie Peering. George Rudabush and Julie Peering are going to be talking together. And, you know, the values of compassion, I think they're going to go back to, you know, some of the early philosophers and talking about, you know, eudaimonia, the good life, you know, the value of extending oneself past oneself and things like that. We have some other talks starting out the day with some sociologists talking about teaching with compassion, training the mind to teach with the heart. We have another session on service.
Compassion through service seems the obvious
thing.
I mean, when we think of compassion, we think of people doing service.
Right.
And tutoring, literacy tutoring, working at the food bank, and all that sort of thing.
And we have a lot. We'll have a lunchtime free lunch, and we'll have a sort of a poster presentation of some community agencies, just like the ones you're describing. And service is a part, and we'd like students to see, you know, because it is at NAU, to sort of see, you know, these are ways I can exercise my heartfelt desire to help people. But one of the things that I really had as a goal for this conference was to show students, first of all, to bring the community together with the university, but maybe to give students the idea that I don't have to wait till I'm retired to be compassionate.
There you go. Good.
That I can actually do something now, that it can be part of my everyday life.
Good.
And to show people and how many disciplines care about this, that this really just isn't this thing out there to do when I have the time, right?
Well, that's what's amazing, that you had all those disciplines. So I would have expected, you know, half a dozen to, you know.
So the conference is this Friday, February 8th. It runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m.
Is it open to the public?
It's completely open to everyone, and I sure hope doesn't cost anything except for a $4 parking pass if you're.
So it's a communist convention.
Yes, exactly. We have we're luring people in with food, and we have in addition to these sessions, we also have some breakout workshops, and I guess I can put in a plug. So Steve will be here doing one of the workshops on politics of compassion, but we have three other. At the same time,
attend to somebody else's?
I'm attending, by the way, Stephen. I'm bringing my flask, so that's all we'll say about you and your
Heidi. When we finish talking about this, I want to ask you where compassion comes from in the human mind, because you are a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, but anyway, there's compassion in action, fostering a compassionate response to life's challenges is one of the conferences. Mm-hmm. Practical tools to cultivate compassion. And another one is teaching with compassion, training the mind. And I guess the question is, you know, where's compassion come from and how is it that you can teach compassion or train the mind to think in compassionate ways?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it overlaps with some of the work I'm doing. People have a lot of different ways to teach compassion. So one, you know, classic way that a lot of very popular now, and I'm sure you've all heard of it, is this, you know, mindfulness training. And there's compassion meditation, and there's, you know, there's a long tradition within the, you know, Buddhist and Christianity in terms of I mean, you can call it mindfulness, but that's a word for basically, you know, being aware and being in the present moment. And, you know, workshops, week-long training, compassionate meditation, you know, consciously thinking about other people that you love, and then broadening that out to people that you like, and then people that you don't know, and then even maybe people that you don't like, you know.
Yeah, right.
But though some of the work I do is in that same vein, but I found a much simpler way to do that, and that's just simply to remind people of the values that they already hold. Like literally, it's probably maybe a bad analogy, but I sort of think of it as a, you know, those little cards where you can scratch and then you smell bubble gum or something that. That literally, it's kind of like that. Just like scratch the compassionate values and go, that's right. That is what I think. That those are important to me. And I think in the everyday hustle bustle of life and our need to you know, conform to the values of putting ourselves out there and getting ahead and being better.
10 years ago. Yeah. I read a study. You ask Americans whether they supported the death penalty. 70% said yes, until you had any conversation about the death penalty. And that number dropped to 50%. It was almost as you're saying, you scratch them a little bit,
right.
And the compassion comes out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, realizing that you can protect society by just not killing someone. You can lock them up. There's lots of ways of protecting society. And all those other things, and as soon as like there's any discussion, the number drops to 50%. Mm-hmm. And now, I believe it's less than 50%, and that's right. The whole other movement going on. And as far as that particular expression of compassion, supporting state-sponsored murder, or at least killing, is one thing. Mother Teresa has a prayer, at least it's ascribed to her. It's one. You know, when you get to be like as big as Mother Teresa, I think it's like being a star. You know, you get quotes ascribed to you. Maybe you'll be that big someday. But anyway, the last line of the prayer is, the fruit of service is peace. And she goes through the whole thing about the fruit of love is this and the fruit of this. But the fruit of service is peace is how she chose to end the poem. And in this... And I guess if there's a symbol of compassion, the Time magazine articles notwithstanding, the Mother Teresa, at least, and I'm not even sure she, although the Christians claim her, I believe she's larger, and certainly that kind of effort is larger than any single religion.
What's the effect? And Mike's talking about Mother Teresa and the effect of compassion bringing peace. What is the effect on the human mind, personality, of being compassionate as a fairly regular thing?
Yeah. Well, you know, I love that question. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in all this, I was a coping and stress and coping researcher, and I was studying the reactions to bereavement primarily. And to make a long story short, you can really look at reactions to bereavement and trauma. You know, there's a distressing, depressive, anxiety kind of reaction, you know. Then there's also grief and sort of more outward-focused reaction. And so after 9/11, I did a study of people who didn't know anyone, but, you know, that was a huge event and everybody could identify. And it really became clear that the feeling of connection with other people was related to grief and some very, very profound sadness and you know, the recognition of our own mortality and the uncontrollability of life, and that we typically go through life not remembering any of that stuff. We prefer to think that that life is predictable and controllable. And all that, and that's a shattering, what Ronnie Janoff Bowman, a well-known social psychologist, calls the shattering of our illusions. So what was interesting about that is that in that kind of intense circumstance, as you guys remember what that was like,
I was there. I was 5 blocks north of the World Trade Center when it came down.
People were very connected. They were in a lot of pain, right, but also felt
there was a huge overflowing sense of community and solidarity.
Right. In the midst of all that pain. And so what became clear is that pain, that compassion, is not a euphoric stance. You know, it's a recognition of our own mortality. It's a recognition of the frailty of human life. And I think the reason people fear that place a little bit is because it is uncomfortable and it is a little bit sad. But I think that it's that's that bittersweet place. And I think, you know, what happens to the mind when a person exercises more compassion? First of all, I don't know that the goal is to be compassionate with quotation marks, you know, 24/7. That would be ideal. Some people strive for that. Mm-hmm. My goal more is, can we try to introduce more of it in our everyday lives? You know, can we just increase it somewhat? You know, there's the goal isn't perfection here, because it is a tough place to maybe be, you know, because when we do recognize that, I feel a little sad, you know, to be honest. But then there's joy and the emotions kind of mingle. You know, you have, again, that real bittersweet place. And I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with feeling that, you know, that, and then
there's also, I suppose, some guilt. I'm standing in the street at 9/11. The building just come down. I walk a couple of blocks away. There are these two old bums that look like the classic New York red face, bashed in nose bums. And I'm standing in the street looking back at the World Trade Center. And one of the guys says to the other one was, "You were a medic in Nam, and so was I. Let's go." Wow. And these two bums start heading down. Now, understand, people have jumped out the windows. You can't tell paper from glass. You can't tell furniture from people jumping. They're walking down there. And I started to follow them, right? And I thought, I don't know anything about first aid or anything. Yeah. I'm just going to be in the way, and I have family responsibilities, and it's a 7-mile walk home and all of this sort of stuff. But I watched them, these sort of bow-legged guys head off to do it. They were trained in the Army to help people. Mm-hmm. And even though it's, what, decades later, they see that, and their immediate response is compassion. Do something to help. They know what it means. They know people are getting hurt.
Right.
I was stunned.
That fits our definition of compassion. At the beginning of the show, we started with a definition of compassion. They saw it, they processed it, and then they acted.
Right, and they had the ability, and I think that's one thing that we know from research, is that to get anyone to do anything, you know, well, here we're talking about compassion, but if it's about changing health behavior or anything, that you have to feel like you can do what's being asked of you. I mean, one of the biggest barriers to, you know, any kind of behavior change is just the idea that, yeah, I know what I need to do, but if I don't think I can do it, I won't do it. Or if I'm afraid that my actions will be wrong or something. So there's a barrier there. And so part of maybe what this compassion conference can do is, by broadening the definition a little bit, maybe we can show people that they can make these small kinds of compassionate.
Well, that's very true.
Thoughts,
I mean,
right?
Getting on a train or a plane and going down to Guatemala and helping them build clean water facilities, not everybody thinks they can do that.
Right.
And it takes a leap of faith to be corny to
people,
do that.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Mike, too, that people don't think they can become more compassionate. Mm-hmm. They don't understand what the process is. And go to your earlier point, you can call it self-protection, overriding fear. Mm-hmm. It's hard to break through the shell of self-protection. I want to protect my house and my money and my lifestyle and my family. And, you know, if I go down to Guatemala and help people, maybe there's some terrible disease I'll die of in Guatemala, far from home, or whatever it is. People don't have confidence that they can do anything to create a more compassionate world, a more compassionate
society. Before we run out of time, I do want to apply this to you got a speaker on compassionate politics, right? And so we're going to have to. But I want the two experts are across the room on compassion and politics. I believe it's a huge contradiction of terms. And, you know, I walked in laughing, saying, "You got to be kidding. We're not talking about this today." But no, seriously, I get compassion. I get politics. How are you guys want to bring this together? What are you going to say in your speech?
There's a kind of lineage of compassion in politics.
Oh, there you
that
go.
That goes from Leo Tolstoy to Gandhi to Martin Luther King to everybody else, to Mandela. And it's, you know, I mean, I think I was talking to Mike and I was saying in politics and compassion, we're sort of the slow learners. We're the guys who are behind everybody else, the guys who are building an orphanage in Guatemala are way ahead of us in a lot of ways.
I see.
But there's a lineage, and it comes from Leo Tolstoy, whose actual name was Lev Tolstoy.
Gandhi?
He has an oceanic mind. War and Peace has 680 characters. He becomes a very radical Christian. Deeply Christian, based on the Sermon on the Mount. He writes a letter to a Hindu activist in India and advocates throwing the British out of India. I call it pushing them out of India nonviolently. Nothing happens for about a year. And a man named Mahatma Gandhi is living in South Africa, reads Tolstoy's letter. He writes Tolstoy to make sure Tolstoy actually wrote it. You're talking about self-protection.
Are you real?
And they begin a dialogue, and he returns to India, and he pushes the thing out. So the way compassion works is very practical. So I was at the last sit-in in Oklahoma at the last segregated lunch counter at Earl's Drugstore in Lawton, Oklahoma. So I won't go into the whole story, but Earl was the last guy in Oklahoma who had a segregated lunch counter, and a bunch of students, we were down there for an NAACP conference, and in Oklahoma, the youth group was run by somebody who did direct action. So she said to us, we were at the conference, she said, how'd you like to go have a Coke at Earl's? We said, sure, we'll go have a Coke at Earl's. So she says, Earl's not going to be happy to see us. So we drive there, and one of the things that happened is we're going in to sit in. There's two kinds of sit-ins, soft ones and hard ones. Mm-hmm. A soft one, we're going to leave. You know, when the police come, a hard one to carry you out.
Oh,
this is a soft sit-in. So we're going to the soft sit-in. The man who drives us there, a young black man, doesn't come in. He's not nonviolent. He won't practice nonviolent. I've been talking to him. I really like the guy. We talked about philosophy and stuff. But he doesn't come in because already nonviolence that Martin Luther King and so many others are teaching doesn't reach everybody. He's not, if somebody comes mm-hmm. and pours ketchup on him, he's going to punch him out. Mm-hmm. So he's not coming in.
Got it.
Right. So we go in and we sit down and I go with my friend Levi. We go to the lunch counter and order and they refuse the service. And, I go and I sit down, and where I decide to sit down, because the next couple of people comes up and gets refused service, my nose is at the level of a bunch of douchebags. So I stand up.
Literally.
Literally. So I stand up and I watch the woman who's running it and the sergeant who's in charge of the police arrive. The guy looks like Bull Connor.
Yeah.
But they're friendly. You know, he says, hey, Louisa, how are you? He says, all right, Jim, how are you doing? He says, well, what's it going to be? He looks at all of us sitting down. Is it going to be a hard sit-in or a soft sit-in? All right. What we're not doing is we're not trying to hurt Earl, right? We're not trying to get revenge on Earl. He's told people, he's insulted people by telling them they can't eat at his lunch counter. Mm-hmm. We're not burning down his drugstore. We're not tearing it up. We're not breaking the windows. We're not following him to his house. We're not even saying anything mean about him. We may think he's an ornery old fart, but we're not really doing that. So what Tolstoy starts is a stream in politics of nonviolence, right? And I guess that's what I would say, Mike, and mm-hmm. is part of it. And it just kind of carries on. And so, again, we're kind of behind the curve in politics. Like, so in South Africa, just not trying. I mean, the white South Africans murdered the black revolutionaries there. They murdered civil rights workers. They tortured them. They imprisoned them for decades. And when they got power, when Mandela got power, he didn't seek revenge. That's the first step. You try not to get revenge. Even in war, Mike mentioned, you know, warrior culture. In war, you give quarter. You know, if somebody is beaten, and there was a recent incident in Israel where a young Palestinian guy is shot, and then the Israeli soldier then finishes him off, right? Hmm. In war, you don't do that. I mean, there's compassion even in war. There's the proper treatment of prisoners. It infiltrates everything we're going to do. So that's my take on this. But again, I think, Heidi,
anyway,
we're way behind you in terms of doing compassion in politics.
But I just have to say, like last year, you know, we had a speaker from our criminal justice program, but, you know, and argued, and there's some merit too, that compassion isn't just laying down. And I mean, you know, there's obviously a rich history here with what you're describing, and it's very effective. But, and I'm not advocating violence, but sometimes where, and you mentioned this earlier, that people think, well, compassion is just this wishy-washy thing where people can just walk all over you and you just keep taking it. I think it's really important to know that compassion can also include standing up for what you believe in and making some noise about that. So, you know, I don't know how fine-grained that analysis needs to be, but compassion isn't just laying down,
right,
and dying, right?
And you'll find out when you go listen to Steve's speech, and you get to hear him say "Oceanic Mind" one more time, and then you can raise your hand during the Q&A and say, "Tell us again what an oceanic mind." Oh, it's a great phrase.
Well, how many characters?
His mind meld between Tolstoy and Gandhi apparently is the definition of the oceanic mind.
It is a tradition, and what it is you don't do any more violence. I mean, I don't think that Tolstoy would have approved of what Gandhi did exactly had he lived a little longer, because Gandhi is pushing the British out of India. And we're pushing Earl to integrate his lunch counter. But we're not hitting him. We're not attacking him. We're not trying to harm him. And we're stopping at just what we can accomplish by direct action. In other words, you know, we're not trying to get at him more than what he's doing wrong.
But you are standing up, right? And so
that's
an important thing of, right?
Of course. I mean, I was 18 years old. The whole time I was thinking about my parents are going to kill me if I get arrested. And the whole panoply of stuff.
Leave that part out.
Yeah. But I think that that's right. I mean, in other words, it is about standing up a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's... And I think, you know, I think what's important to me, what you said, is where you get the energy to do this and where you get the feeling of compassion. Because what we're doing in politics, you can feel compassion or not, you're following certain rules. So after we do our soft sit-in, 2 weeks later they have a hard sit-in, they're carried out. They're all young black students. They're all trained in nonviolence. You can beat on them, and they're not going to fight back. And then Earl integrates his drugstore, and the last lunch counter in Oklahoma is integrated. Mm-hmm. But it is being pushy in the sense, but not violent. And I don't know how that relates to the broader issues you're raising about compassion.
Well, just as you mentioned nonviolence too, one of those. So again, in the afternoon, there's these four different workshops people can attend. Again, all this is free, no cost. But one of them is by some nonviolent communication trainers, you know, just to talk about nonviolent communication and how to listen with empathy. Got a couple of those in addition to Steve's politics of compassion. And then we actually have a faculty member of ours who's going to talk about how creativity can unleash the compassionate person, because sometimes just getting in touch with our with our creativity and you know, being, again, sort of getting out of the mind of just the self-driven, self-enhancement mode, and sometimes just giving to others, doing for others in creative ways can help lead to compassion as well.
That's it. We're talking to Heidi Wayman here, and she's advocating and helping put on a conference at NAU this weekend. I want to read some of these other on compassion, and I want a compassion in action, fostering compassionate response to life challenges. Another one I like is called Practical Tools to Cultivate Compassion. So we started the show once again that compassion is kind of a squishy term, but I feel like at least for the 45 minutes we have hardened its definition. I think we've made it clear. I'm not sure that the rest of the world will play this show over and over. But once again, we want to get the time and the place of the conference.
Yeah, it's on Friday, and it's on the NAU South Campus. We'll have NAU parking just right in the parking lot near. It's in the Du Bois Ballroom, if you're familiar with NAU. We'll have a parking out there selling parking passes for $4. That's the entire cost. Starts at 8:30.
Free lunch, free snacks.
All day. Goes through 3:45, and in the afternoon, which is really looking forward to this session, we have in our honors program, we have Cassie Dakin, who's been teaching a course to students called A Life of Meaning, Contemplation, Compassion, and Community. And so getting to the students and teaching them, and again, I think it's a really important thing that we do have a young generation out there that's been often characterized as the most me-centered generation ever.
Well, that's it. I just had a guy want to move to the Verde Valley, and when he gets here, and I saw this guy in a search, as many are, a search for meaning. And when he gets here, he was asking me, grilling me on volunteer opportunities. And which I have to admit I've not seen, but it was a pleasant thing, to say the least. And I'm prepared to let him know all the things he can do when he gets there. But he is older and retired, and now he has the time to do this, and this is what he wants to do. But I wish he was here this weekend. I'd send him to this conference. Heidi Wayman here is talking about compassion in everyday life. Teaching compassion, a value for life. We have lots of teachers that listen to us. Certainly this is in your bailiwick and your wheelhouse, charter schools, public schools. Seems like we could all use it, except, you know, the state will just deny you more money because you're a bunch of, you know, this liberal topics aren't going to fly for very long.
I mean, compassion, right, Heidi, shouldn't be a liberal or conservative.
No.
It shouldn't be that. It should be
it's
something
a human
beyond
response,
that.
Right? It's a human thing.
We've got a couple of minutes left.
Thank you for slapping me around. Here.
And where does compassion come from? I mean, why are we compassionate? And you have 1.5 minutes to answer this question.
Oh, yeah, well, that's an easy one, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, you know, Darwin and others have talked about it, just hardwired into our survival. We're social beings, first and foremost.
That's good news.
We know that without other people, I mean, you know, we're doomed. We are social creatures. And so part of that social contract is the golden rule, right?
I hope that's true.
That's just a fundamental need.
You and Bernie
need,
forever.
So.
we want to thank our friends, the Democrats of the Red Rocks, for throwing a few bucks our way to help keep Democratic Perspective. Inviting guests like Heidi Wayman from NAU, social psychologist, to tell us about her conference this weekend. Find out about it. It's Friday. Go there. Learn some things. Find, you know, life's meaning.
Meet people with a lot of similar interests. So again, Friday, Du Bois, and it's a nice day. Lots of different philosophy, education, sociology. Talk to people, and I guarantee you'll like it.
And lots of choices of the programs you can go to.
Right.
Yes, just politics, for sure.
Right.
That's only one small phase of it.
Yeah.
We have this and other all of our shows available to you on vvid.org, vvid.org. We have all our old podcasts. You can get this show in a few days when it shows up there. You can also hit the donate button which is everybody's begging for dough. We're not different. So please, folks, thank you for tuning in. VVID.org. Please listen to our podcasts. Thank you.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.